movie does. The Shining is simply disturbing, serving Kubrick's vision well. The two little girls inviting Danny to play, the discomforting scene with the man dressed as a dog, the sense of increased dread as the walls close in on the Torrance family, the obvious mental disintegration of Jack Torrance as he slowly loses his grip on reality. All of these elements work in unison, and powerfully so. After viewing it at the theater, I left with a sense of dislocation, immersed in the movie and its haunting elements. I appreciated what Kubrick set out to do, and what he accomplished, though I knew Stephen King would come away displeased. King, after all, is mostly interested in characters, in making an emotional connection with the reader/viewer, and he does so by carefully drawing portraits of sympathetic characters so that, when they are in danger, we feel their fear. But Kubrick's vision for The Shining wasn't about the family at all. It was about the Overlook itself. The people, to him, were of secondary concern. So, in the end, Spielberg is right. It's the ultimate haunted house movie, though it should have been the ultimate haunted person/family movie in the form of Jack Torrance. This explains why King wanted to redo the movie. He wanted to restore the family as its center. The Shining is, after all, a haunted movie about a dysfunctional family. When King decided to do a remake, he contractually needed Kubrick's permission. Kubrick gave it, but with a non-negotiable requirement. Stephen King had to stop complaining to the media about Kubrick's film, and King agreed. He no longer speaks out against the film, preferring to talk about his own version. As for the remake, it was directed by Mick Garris, with a script by King, who also served as executive producer. Stephen King's The Shining, a three-part miniseries for television, aired in 1997. This second time around, and based on King's own screenplay, it was partially shot at the Stanley Hotel, and the casting reflected King's choices. Stephen Weber played Jack Torrance, Rebecca De Mornay played Wendy Torrance, and Cortland Mead played Danny Torrance. They were all relatable in a way that Jack Nicholson, Shelley Duvall, and Danny Lloyd were not. Moreover, the luxury of shooting for television gave King's version more room to breathe. 273 minutes broken up in three 91-minute episodes. Speaking about his own movie at a press conference, the Ritz-Carlton Huntington Hotel in Pasadena, January 9, 1997, he was joined by director Mick Garris, Stephen Weber, and Rebecca De Mornay. King explained, "What I did was to try to write the truest, most wrenching story. The Shining is a story about a haunted hotel, but it's also a story about a haunted marriage, and the two should work together. The reality of that abusive relationship should enhance and make the ghost story even more frightening. But let's face it, I tried to write a scary book, and I didn't see any sense in taking it and prettying it up for TV, so I went to ABC and said, 'Do you have a problem with this if we do this, this, and this?' And they said, 'No, we can do that for TV. I think people who've read the book know what they're in for. And I think people who tune in, well, hopefully I think that story succeeds on its own terms. That if a story is good, and if the characters are believable, and if the acting is good, and if the direction works, if all those things work, people get into the story and they want to live in that world for a while. They're willing to go into that car of the roller coaster and go up the slope. We're promising them a scary ride, but one that they'll come back from alive.'" Given that King's 1997 remake succeeds in correcting what he perceives as egregious in Kubrick's film, the TV miniseries is in essence a different take based on the same source. We see Kubrick's version and also King's, and as to what the viewer prefers, it's a matter of taste that depends largely on where one's sympathies lie. Note, King has steadfastly refused to write sequels, but he felt impelled to tell the story of what happened to Danny Torrance, who escaped with his mother from the Overlook Hotel. The sequel, Dr. Sleep, will surely see a major motion picture release. In the meantime, though, Hollywood is going back to The Shining with a prequel, The Overlook Hotel, to be directed by Mark Romanek, with a script by Glenn Mazzara. No date has been announced, and it's worth noting that Stephen King is not involved. But this prequel should tap into Before the Play, a reworked version of The Shining's original prologue, told in 5 scenes, that his publisher unwisely jettisoned because of length issues. The prologue properly sets the stage for what is to follow, and is required reading to fully enjoy the novel. But if Before the Play is not a starting point for the prequel, then I, for one, am not optimistic. I'd rather not see another King film that trades more on his name than on a faithful adaptation of his work, because it's not about fidelity. It's about infidelity, and screwing everybody over at their expense in pursuit of profits for the studio and its shareholders. And the writer be damned. Multiple takes. Stephen King. I'm not a cold guy. I think one of the things people relate to in my books is this warmth. There's a reaching out and saying to the reader, I want you to be a part of this. With Kubrick's The Shining, I felt that it was very cold, very, we're looking at these people, but they're like ants in an anthill. Aren't they doing interesting things, these little insects? BBC interview with Will Gompertz, September 19th, 2013. Diane Johnson, screenwriter. I'm not a big Stephen King fan. I'm not a big horror story fan. But I thought when I was reading it that it had a sort of surprising scariness, considering its flaws, how kind of pretentious and predictable it is. But at the same time, it was scary. So I admired it in that sense. I know that King didn't really like the film. And I can sympathize with that because we did come out with a completely different thing. His book is very Baroque, and you can't really do that in film. It had to be radically simplified. Mark Steensland, TerrorTrap.com, May 2011. Shelley Duvall. So here was my chance to work with Kubrick. Going through day after day of excruciating work, almost unbearable. Jack Nicholson's character had to be crazy and angry all the time. And in my character, I had to cry 12 hours a day, all day long, the last 9 months straight, 5 or 6 days a week. After I made The Shining, all that work, hardly anyone even criticized my performance in it. Even to mention it seemed like. The reviews were all about Kubrick, like I wasn't there. Perhaps with a star director such as Kubrick, I said, critics get mesmerized by his name and forget the actors. Interviewed by Roger Ebert, December 14, 1980. Available on rogerebert.com. The critics take. Alexandre Aja, director of Horns. I was fully mesmerized. I watched maybe a half hour of it, but it was enough time to present the twin sisters and a vision of the elevator with all the blood floating out. I talk a lot about the immersive experience as the ultimate quest in making all my movies, but I think my desire to be into a movie, living it and not just watching it, came from that first experience of being sucked into that flow of images that Stanley Kubrick put together, where each element, from the music to the sound design to the choice of focal length, everything created an experience from which there was no escape. It was way beyond my expectations. Hero Complex. Los Angeles Times, October 29, 2014. Laura Miller. Salon.com. The Shining, in my opinion, is a terrific film. But I suspect that even if King accepted the brilliance and the talent, and for all I know he does, they would not make up for what he feels the movie lacks in humanity. Humanity is what matters most to him, and all the browbeating of all the fanboys in the world is not going to change his mind on that. Kubrick can be the bigger genius. King would rather be the bigger man. Josh Larson, LarsonOnFilm.com. The Shining is terrifying for what it doesn't do. We're left to fill in the blanks with our own active imaginations, and of course we fill them with pure dread. What I didn't know how to handle were murdered twins fixing me with their blank stares, decomposing bodies rotting in tubs. Whatever was going on in that room with the well-dressed man and the person dressed as a rabbit, bear? For all the fast edits and ugly insert shots that have come to dominate contemporary horror, Kubrick is the only one who truly perfected what those posers are after. Sheer subliminal terror. 3. Cujo. He was a good dog. Release date, August 12, 1983. Tomato meter, 59%. Audience score, 45%. Screenplay by Don Carlos Dunaway and Lauren Currier. Directed by Louis Teague. Budget, $8 million. U.S. box office receipts, $21 million. Key cast, Dee Wallace as Donna Trenton, and Danny Pintauro as Tad Trenton. This ranks high on King's list of films, but not so much with critics or fans. Even still, it's a compelling film because, unlike the horror films he's known and celebrated for, the horror hits closer to home in this flick. A dog is bit by a rabid bat and changes into a crazed, relentless beast who, after killing his abusive owner and an innocent neighbor, attacks a woman and her son, who are trapped in a Ford Pinto. Stephen King's recollection in a 2006 Paris Review interview was that it was the first new car we ever owned. We had problems with it right away because there was something wrong with the needle valve in the carburetor. It would stick, the carburetor would flood, and the car wouldn't start. I was worried about my wife getting stuck in that Pinto, and I thought, what if she took that car to get fixed like I did my motorcycle and the needle valve stuck and she couldn't get it going? But instead of the dog just being a mean dog, what if the dog was really crazy? It's not a flashy movie, but it's relentless, just like Cujo. The movie just keeps coming and coming and never lets up. Multiple takes. Stephen King. It's one of the scariest things you'll ever see. It's terrifying. Stephen King from A to Z. Dee Wallace. The minute I read Cujo, I knew that mother. I am the quintessential mother caretaker. So I understood before I ever had a child that I would give myself up entirely for a child if I had to. Now that I have a child, I understood that even more. For me, it was, my God, I'm blessed with the opportunity to bring this alive. And I was very active in getting the ending of Cujo changed. Actually, Stephen King wrote us and said, thank God you changed the end. I never got more hate mail than when I killed the boy at the end of Cujo. You cannot ask a theater audience to go through and invest all this love and then pulling for this little boy to be saved and then rip that away from them. And obviously it doesn't work in the book. Denofgeek.us. The Critics Take. Rob Vo. Mania.com, August 2013. King's knack for characterization made the dog as sympathetic as the hapless humans it menaced, and proved more than a dedicated animal lover like me could bear. The movie adaptation gets half of that equation right, thanks to an impressive performance from Dee Wallace as the mother. Fresh off of her standout performance in E.T., she embraced the grindhouse grit of the material here, and cemented her status as a grade-A scream queen in the process. Cujo works almost solely because of her, though King's basic scenario doesn't hurt the equation either. Jason Thompson, bulls-eye.com. Cujo is definitely a Stephen King adaptation that doesn't suck. The pacing is well-balanced, the tension is palpable, and the fears are based on things all too frighteningly real. Suffice it to say that Louis Teague knew what the hell he was doing when directing this picture. 4. The Dead Zone. Life as a Wheel of Fortune. Release date, October 21st, 1983. Tomato meter, 90%. Audience score, 76%. Screenplay by Jeffrey Bohm. Directed by David Cronenberg. Budget, $7 million. U.S. box office domestic total gross, $20.7 million. Key cast, Christopher Walken as Johnny Smith, Brooke Adams as Sarah Bracknell, and Martin Sheen as Greg Stilson. The hardest King movies to adapt are the straight horror movies, because they either brilliantly succeed or fail, relying heavily on special effects to induce the willing suspension of disbelief. The easiest King movies to adapt are those without any supernatural elements, like Stand By Me and The Shawshank Redemption. In between are the ones like Carrie and The Dead Zone, in which the supernatural plays an important element, but not overwhelmingly so. In other words, by focusing on characters, which is always King's main interest, the movies hew closer to the heart of King's fiction and are therefore easier to film. By 1983, with Carrie, Salem's Lot, The Shining, and Creepshow establishing King as a horror writer, and with director Cronenberg identified with horror films, the Internet Movie Database says his nicknames are the King of Venereal Horror and Baron of Blood. The release of a non-horror movie like The Dead Zone broke new ground for both of them. King's departure from Doubleday to New American Library was marked with his first novel that didn't rely on traditional elements of horror, The Dead Zone, and the movie version reflected it. As with Cujo, the evil was not external but internal. As Douglas E. Winter explained in The Art of Darkness, "The evil within is a traditional horror theme, often expressed in the form of a logical insistence that unpleasant consequences await those who meddle in matters best left undisturbed." In Creepshows, Stephen Jones explains that The Dead Zone was Cronenberg's biggest hit, both critically and commercially, up to that date. "Cronenberg did one of the great jobs of his life," King later said. "He got tremendous performances out of people, but the movie was not able to break through." For Christopher Walken, who at that time was best known for his small but memorable role as Dwayne Hall in Woody Allen's Annie Hall, 1977, and as a tortured, imprisoned soldier named Nick in The Deer Hunter, 1978. The Dead Zone put him on center stage with the role of Johnny Smith. Film magazine Cine Fantastique, December 1983 to January 1984, stated it was not only the finest work to date by director David Cronenberg and the best adaptation of a Stephen King novel, but a splendid film by any standard. In almost every way and on many levels, The Dead Zone is a glowing success. Multiple takes. Stephen King. It went through a number of hands and ended up with Dino De Laurentiis and directed by David Cronenberg. I'm going to see a rough cut on Monday when I'm back in New York, but I saw 20 minutes of it cut together and I thought it was gorgeous. Martin Anderson, 1983, Shadowlocked.com. Roger Ebert. The Dead Zone does what only a good supernatural thriller can do. It makes us forget it is supernatural. Walken does such a good job portraying Johnny Smith, the man with the strange gift, that we forget this is science fiction or fantasy or whatever and just accept it as this guy's story. October 26, 1983. Posted on RogerEbert.com. David Cronenberg. I loved working with Christopher Walken. I thought I'd work with him again, but there was never quite the role. I had a pretty good time with all of my leading men and women, really. So I could imagine a movie which they were all in. The way Fellini in 8 Ra had everybody in his life, all his actors in a dance with him. Tim Lewis, September 13, 2014, TheGuardian.com. 5. Stand By Me, Stephen King's Childhood Journey. For a long time, I thought I would love to be able to find a string to put on the childhood experiences that I remember. A lot of them are funny, and some of them are kind of sad. The people that I've known and some of the guys I hung out with that really weren't headed anywhere but down blind alleys. And nothing came. And what you do when nothing comes is you don't push. You just put it aside. And there came a day when I thought to myself, if these guys go somewhere, if there's a reason for them to go somewhere and do something, what could it be? I came up with the idea of going down the train tracks to look for the body of a kid that I made up. A situation whereby they would know the body was there, and they could go and find it. And everything else follows from that. Most stories, good stories about boys, are about journeys. Stephen King, The Tracks, The Summer of Stand By Me, from the DVD edition of Stand By Me. Release date, August 22, 1986. Tomato meter, 91%. Audience score, 95%. Screenplay by Reynold Gideon and Bruce A. Evans. Directed by Rob Reiner. Budget, $8 million. Domestic total gross, $52.2 million. Stephen King cites this movie as his favorite among all the adaptations to date, and it's easy to understand why. A classic film based on King's most autobiographical story, The Body, Different Seasons, 1982. This elegiac film plumbs the depths of King's childhood, a time he vividly recalled, and one that he brought to life with remarkable fidelity, as did Reiner for the film version. Consider the similarities to King himself. The story and film are set in 1959, when King was 12 years old. The backdrop is small-town Maine, recalling Lisbon Falls, where he attended high school. And his best friend is Chris, who, as in the story, goes on to the University of Maine at Orono, as King did. King, who worked at the Warrumbo Mill in Lisbon Falls during high school and college, feared being trapped in that small town. In the movie, we meet four young teens. The narrator is a 12-year-old boy named Gordy LaChance, who is the smart one. He goes on to become a best-selling writer. All the others, his best friend, Chris Chambers, Teddy Duchamp, and Vern Tessio, die, never seeing their dreams come to fruition, because, as John Lennon once remarked, life is what happens when you're making other plans. Chris, who realized his dream of being accepted to the university, intervenes in a knife fight in a fast food restaurant and gets killed. Teddy, a real wet end, dies ingloriously in a car crash, taking others with him. And Vern, everybody's good buddy, dies in an accidental house fire. At the end of the movie, we see Gordon LaChance watching Ace Merrill, who terrorized him when he was 12. Ace, now overweight and resigned to his humdrum life at the mill, heads for a bar where he'll seat his fat ass on a bar stool and bitch about life. A coming-of-age story, a journey from innocence to experience. The boy's journey doesn't end when they find the dead body in the woods and attempt to claim it, as do Ace Merrill and his minions, contesting their claim. The journey ends further down the road when Gordon becomes an adult, successful by anyone's standards. In 1986, when Reiner screened the film for Stephen King, Reiner recalled seeing King visibly moved. "I have to go away," King said, and he did. When he returned, he told Reiner some of the personal details that made the viewing such an emotional event for him. It brought King's past back to life on the big screen, and he was overwhelmed. But even though knowing the backstory, the connective tissue to King's life, it stands on its own. It's a time machine that takes us back to our past, to a time when we too were 12 and life seemed simple, until we realized our lives are infinite in possibilities, waiting for us to make life's big choices. Multiple takes. Rob Reiner. In the book, it was about four boys, but after about 5 days of driving around, I realized this was really Gordy's story. In the book, Gordy was kind of a dispassionate observer, but once I made Gordy the central focus of the piece, then it made sense to me. This movie was all about a kid who didn't feel good about himself and whose father didn't love him. And through the experience of going to find the dead body and his friendship with these boys, he began to feel empowered and went on to become a very successful writer. He basically became Stephen King. The Telegraph, June 12, 2011. Rob Reiner. King is a good writer. He pens wonderfully complex characters and great dialogue. Yet when people adapt his books into movies, they tend to just concentrate on the horror and the supernatural, All the things that seem to be the most overtly commercial. It's a grave mistake because they lose many levels of his work by doing the obvious. Alan Jones, Starburst Magazine, 1991. Will Wheaton, Gordy LaChance, on River Phoenix during a reunion with Reiner and cast members. I spent much of the next few days remembering all the things we did together during production, thinking about how much I looked up to him and how much I loved his entire family. I don't know what would have happened to us if he hadn't overdosed, if he ever would have come back from the edge, or if we would even have had anything in common. But when he was 15 and I was 13, he was my friend. That's the person I knew, and that's the person I miss. As I drove home from the theater, I was overwhelmed by conflicting emotions. It was wonderful to see those guys again, and especially to reconnect with Jerry. But it was also tremendously sad to truly feel River's loss for the first time. That turbulent mix of joy and sorrow stayed with me for several days. Most actors will go their entire careers without doing a movie like Stand By Me, or working with a director like Rob Reiner. I got to do both when I was 12. For a long, long time, I felt like I needed to top or equal that. And it wasn't until I was in my early 30s that I accepted it's unlikely to happen. Movies like Stand By Me come along once in a generation. Will Wheaton, In Exile. WillWheaton.typepad.com, March 21st, 2011. Cinefantastique Magazine. Those who've sworn off Stephen King movie adaptations take heart. King's novella, The Body, hardly his most typical or flashy, makes the best screen transfer since Carrie. The master of macabre should ditch the killer trucks and direct audiences to this little gem. January 1987. Stephen King. I think they like the voice. The voice can't be filmed, but at the same time it can be. Rob Reiner's proved that twice, particularly with Stand By Me. You would freak, or maybe you wouldn't, if you knew how many people walk up to me on the street and say, "Steve, I love your movies." These people have no idea I do anything but movies. So for every person who read The Body, probably 15 people saw Stand By Me. I still get royalty checks on that film. Big ones. The voice is there. But the only people who are really tapping into the voice are people who read. And they're a small part of the overall population. Bill Warren, Fangoria. 6. Pet Sematary. Sometimes dead is better. Release date, April 21st, 1989. Tomato meter, 43%. Audience score, 60%. Screenplay by Stephen King. Directed by Mary Lambert. Budget, $11.5 million. Domestic total gross, $57.4 million. I got the idea, King told Abe Peck of Rolling Stone in 1980. When my daughter's cat died, it got run over. So anyway, we buried our cat, and I started to think about burials. The movie pays homage to Smucky, as did the book, with a grave marker that reads, "Smucky. He was obedient." In terms of critical reviews and audience popularity, this movie is not in the first rank, but it deserves a place in any discussion of King's movies because it's so main in many ways. To begin with, its real-world setting is Orrington, Maine, where a real pet cemetery, original child spelling, once existed, behind the house that King rented when he commuted to Orno to teach a class at the University of Maine at Orno as its writer-in-residence. In front of the house is a winding road used by truckers that predictably results in roadkill. King, mindful of W.W. Jacobs's story The Monkey's Paw, took it one step further and imagined that the road claimed not only felines and canines, but also people. Specifically, Gage Creed, the son of Dr. Lewis Creed. Pet Sematary was the first King movie to bear his name over the title. It was also the first screenplay he wrote for one of his own movies. and it was the first film he insisted be shot entirely in Maine, in Ellsworth, about an hour away from Bangor, which allowed King to stop by weekly. It also allowed him to fit in a cameo appearance as a preacher, filmed at Bangor's Mount Hope Cemetery. These reasons were important enough to King so that he turned down a $1 million offer, which would have meant ceding control, so that the film's producer, Rich Rubenstein, could afford to secure the rights for just $1,000. Though none of the principal actors are from Maine, Fred Gwynne, best known for his roles in the TV shows Car 54, Where Are You? And The Munsters, in the role of longtime Mainer Judd Crandall, gives a good performance with a spot-on accent, according to lifelong Mainer David Lowell, who said most actors fall way short of the accent mark, so to speak. At its dark heart, Pet Sematary is about the most horrific nightmare a parent can experience, the loss of a child. For that reason, King was reluctant to allow the book to be published. But that's why the transgressive film comes to life to become a real horror show. Multiple takes. Stephen King. Because Pet Sematary of all my novels was the one I thought would be the most difficult to film, I just simply made it an unbreakable part of the deal that whoever was going to do it would have to do it in Maine. And Laurel came along, and Bill Dunn came along and said, "Yeah, okay, we'll make it in Maine." And again, why not? You've got production facilities, lab facilities, and an acting pool to draw on here in New England. And if you need to go to Boston and New York, they're 600 miles down the road, and they're closer than, say, San Francisco is to Los Angeles. We've got stuff up here that nobody's seen. Maine's supposed to be vacation land. And ideally, what should happen is that people should look at the movies and say, "We'd like to go there." And they should come and say, "Gee, this is as great as we saw it." In other words, a movie like Pet Sematary should serve as a commercial for the state, as much as all the movies made in California, Los Angeles, and New York have served as commercials for those places. Press conference for Stephen King's Graveyard Shift, 1990. Stephen King. I think Dale Midkiff is stiff in places. I think Denise Crosby comes across cold in places. I don't feel that the couple that's at the center of the story has the kind of warmth that would set them off perfectly against the supernatural element that surrounds them. I like that contrast better. I think it does what horror movies are supposed to do. Mary Lambert did a good job. She went in and she didn't flinch. In a way, that's a pretty good compliment to the way that I work, because I've always wanted to go straight at things and not try to offer a lot of nuance. My idea is to let go in there and hit as hard as you can. Mary understood that. Gary Wood, Cine Fantastique, February 1991. Mary Lambert. Pet Sematary is about a love of a father for his child that is obsessive to the point of breaking certain taboos, passing certain boundaries that shouldn't be passed. I think I brought a sense of mystery and mysticism to the story that they were looking for. There are certain aspects of this story that take it beyond just another horror movie. Frederick C. Zabin, Cine Fantastique, March 1989. Denise Crosby. I can't imagine not shooting that film in Maine. You needed to be in that place, and we were blessed that we were there and not some Hollywood soundstage. Bangor Daily News, circa 1989. Denise Crosby. I think the fact that he wrote the script made a big difference. He can really tell a story. That's his genius. Gary Wood, Cine Fantastique, February 1991. Fred Gwynne. I see it as a frightening fable rather than a horror film, which I think makes it doubly strong. I'd read the book as soon as it came out. I'm a Stephen King nut. I saw it more as a fable for our times. But it will be interesting to see how the powers that be, where they slot it. New York Times, May 20th, 1989. Unearthed and Untold, The Path to Pet Sematary. Production Company, Oceans Light Productions. At the 15th annual Rhode Island International Horror Film Festival, out of 30 documentaries, Ocean's Light Productions' Unearthed and Untold, estimated release date 2015, took home a grand prize. Just so you know, this is a documentary that requires your attention. With luck, once it passes muster with the powers that be, we'll see it released on DVD. So you can see the work of a two-man team so taken by the novel and film adaptation that they went to Orrington to dig deep into the making of Pet Sematary. "What we're doing," said John Campopiano and Justin White, "is taking a deeper look into the making of the film from two different angles, the perspectives of the main locals and the perspectives of the cast and crew. What stories and memories do local Maine residents have of the production? How was the production documented in local television, magazine, and newspaper stories? What did the production do for the county of Hancock and the greater Maine communities? These are just a few of the questions we are exploring in our documentary. This documentary began when my cameraman and I traveled to Maine over a year ago to see the filming locations. During that weekend, we were overwhelmed by locals who remembered the production and who had home videos, photographs, and a plethora of stories to share. Everyone was so eager and happy to share their memories that I felt we should somehow document them all. This is when our documentary was born." 7. Misery, Staying Alive. He writes stories that cut through the shower of blood. That makes it human. Sharp insights that dig into our innermost secrets. Kathy Bates, introducing Stephen King, August 1st, 2006. Release date, November 30th, 1990. Tomato meter, 89%. Audience score, 89%. Screenplay by William Goldman. Directed by Rob Reiner. Budget, $20 million. Domestic total gross, $62 million. Misery, explained King to Cinefantastique's Charles Lehman, illustrates the powerful hold fiction can achieve over the reader. What Misery turned out to be about was the life-saving quality of writing stories, how it takes you away and how it heals, both the people who do it and the people who consume it. It's a theme that King has explored before in The Woman in the Room and also On Writing. In the movie Misery, writing is also a way back to life for romance novelist Paul Sheldon, portrayed by veteran actor James Caan. In fact, it is his only ticket, which Annie Wilkes holds. His novels about Misery Chastain hold an unhealthy influence over Annie Wilkes, and she in turn holds Sheldon as her captive. Distraught that he killed off her favorite fictional character, she demands that Misery be brought back to life by him. She sees it as quid pro quo. She saved his life, and in return, he saves Misery's life. Mindful of Rob Reiner's masterful job as director of Stand By Me, King insisted that if he sold the film rights to Reiner's production company, Castle Rock Entertainment, Reiner had to be its producer, or, King hoped, its director. Reiner signed on as director and delivered a work of film art. In any list of top 10 King film adaptations, Misery deserves a place of high honor. Throwing out a broad net, according to Stephen Jones, writing in Creepshows, Reiner's choices for the key role of writer Paul Sheldon included William Hurt, Kevin Kline, Michael Douglas, Harrison Ford, Dustin Hoffman, Robert De Niro, Al Pacino, Richard Dreyfuss, Gene Hackman, and Robert Redford, all of whom turned it down. Beatty, noted Jones, was interested but was forced to turn it down because of a prior commitment to Dick Tracy. The list narrowed, and Reiner approached James Caan, who was cast in the role. For the other key role of Annie Wilkes, noted Jones, Bette Midler was considered, but Kathy Bates got the role. In fact, when William Goldman wrote the screenplay, he had written it specifically with Bates in mind. Since the movie is essentially claustrophobic, taking place in Annie's isolated farmhouse, the performances of both Caan and Bates had to be riveting, and both were. Khan won no awards for his performance, incurring the wrath of Khan, but Kathy Bates' stellar performance did not go unnoticed. In fact, it earned her an Academy Award, a Golden Globe, a Chicago Film Critics Association Award, a Dallas-Fort Worth Film Critics Award, and third place in the New York Film Critics Circle Award. In other words, Kathy Bates nailed it. Like a high-flying acrobat, she soared. She flew, she spun in the air, and landed perfectly. Kathy Bates was Annie Wilkes in all her implacable horror. It's now difficult, if not impossible, to read the book and not see Annie Wilkes in the image of Kathy Bates because of her riveting film performance. The movie did differ from the book in two critical ways. The role of the sheriff was expanded to open up the claustrophobic movie, which is essentially a one-room play, and instead of giving Paul Sheldon the axe, Annie Wilkes hobbles him instead. Multiple takes. Stephen King. Every now and then, something strange will happen. Some years ago, I went to Philadelphia with my son to see a basketball game. Tabby was here, and she heard the window break, and there was this guy there, and he claimed he had a bomb. In fact, it was a bunch of pencils and erasers and stuff, and paper clips. He was an escapee from a mental institution, and he had this rant about how I'd stolen misery from him. Tabby fled in her bathrobe, and the police came. And every now and then, there'll be a letter from someone who is obviously out there in the ozone. People who are convinced I've stolen their ideas. One lady wrote to explain how I'd overflown her house in a U-2 plane and stolen her thoughts for The Shining. But no one has ever actually threatened to kill me, knock on wood. Though there's a guy out in California, Stephen Lightfoot, who believes that Ronald Reagan and I conspired to kill John Lennon. Tim Adams, September 14, 2000, TheGuardian.com. Rob Reiner. You're trying to just get the performances you want. I hire people who can do what they're supposed to do. I even told Kathy Bates when we were doing Misery, you can't take this character home. This is too crazy. She had started doing that. I said, you let it go. You have your talent, your craft. And you have to trust that when you come to work and that it will be there for you. And it was. It was fine. I've heard people like Daniel Day-Lewis never let go of a character. Everyone works differently. But to me, you have your work and you have your home life. You have to be able to separate the two. Lauren Bradshaw, July 22, 2014. CloturClub.com. Rob Reiner. Kathy kept saying, Jimmy's not relating to me. He's not listening to me. I said, that's true. He isn't. His character doesn't care one iota about yours. And I said, you can use that to fuel your rage. David Sachs, New York Times, January 27, 1991. James Caan. The less I feel I act, the better job I feel I do. I try to keep myself open to possibilities on camera. So Kathy and I work a little different. David Sachs, New York Times, January 27, 1991. Kathy Bates. I have always had a problem with my weight. I'm not a stunning woman. I never was an ingenue. I've always just been a character actor. When I was younger, it was a real problem because I was never pretty enough for the roles that other young women were being cast in. The roles I was lucky enough to get were real stretches for me. Usually a character who was older, or a little weird, or whatever. And it was hard, not just for the lack of work, but because you have to face up to how people are looking at you. And you think, well, you know, I'm a real person. David Sachs, New York Times, January 27, 1991. Kathy Bates. I've admired King's work over the years, but I'm not a horror devotee. I read Metaphysics and Jung and occasionally Clive Barker. I'm an eclectic reader. After this film, it'll start again. More Norman Bates references, and People magazine will refer to me as Kathy Misery Bates. Everybody wants to type you. there's a human urge to pigeonhole. It's just rampant in Hollywood. Glenn Lowell, Daily Press, December 8, 1990. 8. The Shawshank Redemption, redeeming Stephen King's film reputation. I never in a million years thought he would get the film made. Stephen King, Introduction to The Shawshank Redemption, The Shooting Script, 1995. Release date, October 14, 1994. Tomato meter, 91%. Audience score, 98%. Directed by / screenplay by Frank Darabont. Budget, $25 million. Total domestic gross, $28.3 million. Frank Darabont is your typical overnight success. In his case, the overnight success took him 13 years, from the time he worked as a lowly production assistant on a 1981 film called Hell Night, starring Linda Blair. A film described by the Internet Movie Database thus. 4 college pledges are forced to spend the night in a deserted old mansion where they get killed off one by one by the monstrous surviving members of a family massacre years earlier for trespassing on their living grounds. In 1994, Darabont wrote and directed The Shawshank Redemption, which changed his life. His path to Shawshank Prison came by way of a Dollar Baby film, when Darabont received permission from King to film The Woman in the Room, which King said in an introduction to The Green Mile, the screenplay was a beautiful and moving version that he counts as the first and best Dollar Baby short film. Darabont, a gentleman, followed up by sending the award citation for his film to King, who had sized him up correctly. Nice guy. The nice guy went back a second time with a request for a major motion picture, for which he paid $5,000 for the rights. Given a green light by King, Darabont wrote a full-length script for The Shawshank Redemption and sent it to King, who wrote in an introduction to The Green Mile, the screenplay. I gave Frank permission to show the script around. He could shop it until he dropped, as far as I was concerned. But only in my wildest dreams did I expect it would be made. It was too long, too faithful to the source story, and a little too kind. Not even in those wild dreams did I expect it would end up being the screen adaptation of my work that people say they like the best. No mean accomplishment, considering there have been over 30 of them. What King and Darabont didn't expect was that the movie with the awkward title would go on to become a film classic and launch Darabont's film career into high orbit. What's telling about Darabont's character is that when Castle Rock Entertainment got the screenplay, which was written on spec, that is, with no money up front for Darabont, the company wanted Reiner to be at the helm as director and dangled shitloads of money as an inducement. But Darabont remained steadfast and decided being rich overnight wasn't his goal. His goal was to make a world-class film of a story he absolutely loved, and he wanted to bring it to the screen his way. Remember when I said Darabont was a gentleman? He is. And he's a man of integrity who can't be bought. But ironically, The Shawshank Redemption wasn't a box office hit when initially released for several reasons. First, because it was at such variance with the films for which King is known, horror films, the studio heads decided not to use King's name for fear that it might alienate mainstream viewers who would dismiss the film outright and refuse to give it a fair viewing. Second, it's a quiet little story about the relationship between two prison inmates. It's not sexy or action-packed, and it lacks women characters, which they felt would make it less appealing to a general audience. And third, the unrevealing title made it difficult to figure out just what the film was about. What exactly is a Shawshank? A shank, by the way, is prison slang for a homemade knife, so that helped, but not nearly enough. No wonder Tim Robbins' fans came up to him and asked, "What was that shink-shank reduction thing?" Titles aside, the content is what's most important, and in this film there are two standout performances. Morgan Freeman playing Ellis Boyd Red Redding, and Tim Robbins playing Andy Dufresne. Freeman was nominated for an Oscar and a Golden Globe, and Robbins was nominated for a Screen Actors Guild Award and a Clotrudis Award. Unfortunately, in what can only be perceived as a gross miscarriage of justice, both came away empty-handed. The movie, though, had legs. Sturdy legs, as it turned out. It went on to become a critical success and a fan favorite as well. In fact, when the American Film Institute ranked the top 100 greatest movies of all time, The Shawshank Redemption was 72. The readers of Empire magazine voted it the best film of the 90s and the fourth best film of all time. Internet Movie Database subscribers ranked it right up there with The Godfather and Star Wars. As Frank Darabont explained to Empire magazine, it was crash and burn. As I discovered, there's a difference between the audience enjoying a movie and being convinced to show up in the first place. Thank God for video. It went on to become the number one top video rental of 1995, with 320,000 rental copies in the United States alone. It also went on to become a TV favorite, which brought the actors residuals that continue to this day, as Bob Gunton, the prison warden, explained to The Wall Street Journal. I suspect my daughter, years from now, will still be getting checks. By the film's 10th anniversary in 2004, Gunton has gotten close to six figures, noted The Wall Street Journal. Castle Rock Pictures has more or less rescued my film-associated reputation from the scrap heap, and no picture had more to do with that than the one which eventually became known as The Shawshank Redemption, King wrote in his introduction to the script used for shooting, published in book form. King, in fact, loves to recount an encounter he had with a woman who couldn't reconcile the fact that he was the author whose story from Different Seasons, Rita Hayworth and Shawshank Redemption, was the basis for The Shawshank Redemption. Neil Gaiman quoted him in an interview for the Sunday Times. I was down here in the supermarket, and this old woman comes around the corner. Obviously, one of the kind of women who says whatever is on her brain. She said, I know who you are. You are the horror writer. I don't read anything that you do, but I respect your right to do it. I just like things more genuine, like that Shawshank Redemption. And I said, I wrote that. And she said, no, you didn't. And she walked off and went on her way. That woman's reaction, mirroring that of many others, explains the film's enduring appeal. As Tim Robbins recounted to Mark Kermode, all I know is that there isn't a day when I'm not approached about that film. Approached by people who say how important that film is to them, who tell me that they've seen it 20, 30, 40 times, and who are just so thankful. Multiple takes. Stephen King. And Frank will say, I have the world's smallest specialty. I only do prison movies written by Stephen King. And he's been going on about how proud he is that he made The Mist and broke out of that mold. But I told him, Frank, it's still a story about people in prison. They're just in a prison in a supermarket. Gilbert Cruz, Time, November 23, 2007. Frank Darabont. More than cinematic or visual, I first responded to the emotional content of it. The really wonderful characters, the wonderful relationships, the obstacles they face and overcome. Secondarily, there was the visual element of it, which always boiled down to, gee, if we could find a really cool-looking prison to shoot, this is going to be a really cool-looking movie. And luckily that happened. We found the Ohio State Reformatory in Mansfield, Ohio, which they had just shut down 2 years prior. It was an incredible gothic place. Mostly, though, it was the emotional content. It's the little things that make a movie good, the little emotional moments. The rest of it is all candy. Daniel Argent and Eric Bauer, Creative Screenwriting, Volume 4, Number 2, Summer 1997. Morgan Freeman, I don't know what happened when it first came out. In fact, I remember someone asking me on the night of the Academy Awards why I thought Shawshank had done so poorly at box office when films like Dumb and Dumber, which opened the same season, had done so well. After all, Shawshank had gotten pretty good reviews, whereas Dumb and Dumber had been thoroughly and relentlessly trashed by critics. Mark Kermode, August 21, 2004, TheGuardian.com. Tim Robbins. It's a film about people being in jail and having the hope to get out. Why is that universal? Because although not everybody has been in jail, on a deeper, more metaphysical level, many people feel enslaved by their environment, their jobs, their relationships, by whatever it is in the course of their lives that puts walls and bars around them. And Shawshank is a story about enduring and ultimately escaping from that imprisonment. Mark Kermode, August 21st, 2004, TheGuardian.com. 9. Dolores Claiborne, A Happy Accident. Release date, March 24th, 1995. Tomato meter, 82%. Audience score, 81%. Screenplay by Tony Gilroy. Directed by Taylor Hackford. Budget, not stated. Domestic total gross, $24.3 million. As any actor knows, your looks can work for or against you in Hollywood casting, as in real life. In Kathy Bates's case, after winning an Oscar for her performance in Misery, her name would assuredly come up in casting lists for the demanding role of Dolores Claiborne, in which she would have to carry the film on her able-bodied shoulders. But it wouldn't be a glamorous role. There'd be no place for an actress like Nicole Kidman or Cameron Diaz. It needed an actress who, as Bates saw it, doesn't take any guff off anybody, and she becomes hard and crusty to do it. Dolores Claiborne is a plain-talking, unvarnished woman who speaks her mind, and one line from the movie gives us a sense of who she is. Now you listen to me, Mr. Grand High Poobah of Upper Butt Crack. I'm just about half-past give-a-shit with your fun and games. Dolores has seen life up front and personal, and has had it with her husband Joe St. George, who is described in the book as a goddamned millstone I wore around my neck. Worse, really, because a millstone don't get drunk and then come home smelling of beer and wanting to throw a fuck into you at 1 in the morning. Wasn't none of that the reason why I killed the son of a whore? But I guess it's as good a place as any to start. All of us would just like to be real people, Kathy Bates told David Sachs of the New York Times in 1991. But for women especially, somehow movies have gotten to be about glamour. Either you're gorgeous or you're a dog. And I guess I'll find out more about this as I continue working in films. But I have heard a lot. Well, we had something different in mind visually. And no actor likes to hear that. Bates got the coveted role for Dolores Claiborne and delivered an outstanding performance. Filmed off the coast of Nova Scotia, Canada, the movie gives us a sense of Maine divested from any supernatural trappings. Set on Little Tall Island, off the Maine coast, the movie is a microcosm of insular Maine life as seen through the eyes of an islander who has had more than her full share of sorrow and hardship at the hands of her no-account, shiftless husband who, in the novel, didn't leave me a pot to piss in and hardly a window to throw it out of. Joe St. George, who is no saint, left his mark on his wife, and also on their daughter, Selena. And in this memorable film, a psychological thriller, Dolores must not only clear her own name, but build a bridge to reach and reconcile with her daughter, played by Jennifer Jason Leigh, who lives in New York. Unlike other King novels that lend themselves to big box office potential, Dolores Claiborne, bereft of any supernatural component, is one of domestic horror. A woman endures an abusive marriage at the hands of her husband, who also feels their daughter, then underage, is fair game. Kathy Bates's nuanced performance, performed against a gray-brown canvas of an isolated small island off the Maine coast, garnered attention. Screenwriter William Goldman wrote, "No one gave a better performance than Kathy Bates in Dolores Claiborne." And in the 10 most underrated movies, Elizabeth MacDonald, writing for Forbes, 2003, wrote, "Not just the movie, but both actresses, Kathy Bates and Judy Parfitt, should have won Oscars for their searing performances and catty humor." Kathy Bates garnered 3 nominations for her role as Dolores Claiborne, a Saturn Award for Best Actress from the Academy of Science Fiction, Fantasy, and Horror Films, a Chicago Film Critics Association Award, and a Clotrudis Award, as did Jennifer Jason Leigh for Best Supporting Actress. Kathy Bates came away empty-handed on the awards front, but the critics and the fans loved her. And isn't that what really counts? Multiple Takes, Roger Ebert. Stephen King fans hoping for ghouls and satanic subplots and bizarre visitations may be disappointed by Dolores Claiborne. I was surprised how affecting the movie was, mostly because Bates and Lee formed such a well-matched and convincing pair. Does this movie creep up on you? Oh, my gravy. Chicago Sun-Times, March 24, 1995. Janet Maslin. Written as a book-length harangue from its heroine's point of view and directed efficiently by Taylor Hackford, Dolores Claiborne has become a vivid film that revolves around Ms. Bates's powerhouse of a performance. The role of Dolores may be rough around the edges, but it's a windfall for Ms. Bates, who does a walloping good job. She's the perfect, no-nonsense actress to bring this woman to life. New York Times, March 24, 1995. 10. The Green Mile, A Leap of Faith. Do You Believe in Miracles? Release date, December 10, 1999. Tomato meter, 80%. Audience score, 94%. Directed by / screenplay by Frank Darabont. Budget, $65 million. Total domestic gross, $136.8 million. Frank Darabont knows a good story when he reads one, and when he read the first of 6 installments of The Green Mile, he was hooked again. In his introduction to The Green Mile, the shooting script, he explains that he didn't pick up the phone. Instead, he took a plane from Los Angeles to Denver, got a rental car, and drove up to Estes Park and walked in on the TV remake of The Shining, where he saw Stephen King dressed in a white tux and leading a big band. As Darabont recounts, "In between takes, Steve saw me, blinked, and came over to ask what I was doing there. I grabbed him by the lapels, ready to start shaking, and said, 'I've come for the Green Mile.' Steve shrugged and replied, 'Oh, okay, sure. Hey, you want to be an extra in this scene?'" Darabont, who knows that making a full-length feature film is the most demanding and difficult challenge in the creative arts, picks and chooses them carefully. He's driven by passion and commitment and responds to a well-told tale. So when he picked up the 2 dead girls, as he recounted in his shooting script introduction, "What I did know was that I was in the hands of a master storyteller, that I was spellbound, that this was King firing on all pistons. In other words, I decided to proceed purely on a leap of faith, convinced Steve would not let me down." With public expectations high on the heels of The Shawshank Redemption, and a budget big enough to do the film right, including a $20 million paycheck for Tom Hanks as the E-block supervisor at Louisiana's Cold Mountain Penitentiary in 1935, the movie's success would stand or fall on the performance of the actor chosen to play John Coffey, whose initials JC are symbolic. The challenging role required an actor with broad shoulders, and the actor who was finally selected was indeed a big man with broad shoulders and a bigger heart. As Michael Clark Duncan recounted in an interview with Matthew Kinney in 2000 for The John Ankerberg Show, "The role came about by Bruce Willis. He told me about The Green Mile, and he said, 'This will definitely change your career. I'm going to call Frank Darabont when we get back to L.A.,' and he said, 'Mike, go buy the novel now so that when this audition comes up, you'll have a little bit of a better edge than the rest.' We got back to L.A. 4 days later, Frank Darabont calls me. He says he wants me to come in for an audition. I went in. I bring the emotion up. He says, can you come back? I said, okay. I didn't hear from him for about 3 weeks. He then said, I want you to come in for a screen test. That is the big Hollywood thing. They hired me an acting coach, but the role means a lifetime achievement for me. Armageddon put me on the map and let people see me, but this role is my first breakout role. Standing 6 feet 5 inches tall and weighing 315 pounds, Duncan seems better suited to be a bouncer or bodyguard, both of which he had done before getting in the film business. But he found his real talent in acting. Duncan, a gentle giant of a man, brought John Coffey to life on screen in a way that touched millions. As a result, Duncan was showered with accolades and nominated for numerous awards that showed he had acting chops. Like Shawshank, this story is uplifting, said Darabont in Film Review. But this has a much more complex tone. It's also got a sort of lovely melancholy thing going on. I'm looking for something that is hopeful, and that's what I find attractive in these stories. I want something my heart can believe in. What Darabont responded to was John Coffey's numinous quality, which required a nuanced performance from Duncan. If audiences took him to heart and were convinced by his performance, the movie would almost assuredly be a success. Not to make too fine a point here, but Duncan delivered the goods. He just nailed it. Put it on the wall, hammered it in, stood back, and said, in effect, go ahead and take a good look.